Okay. The mitzvah of Gid HaNasher, the prohibition of Gid HaNasher, is a fascinating din. Like, everything's a fascinating din, but this has its own fascinations. And we try throughout the year to try to see a relationship or a possible relationship between the lumdus of a din that we're talking about and how it might reflect some of the hashkafa behind it, some of the tamei hamitzvos. So we saw that, especially we talked about basa b'chala and we talked about shchita, and we saw how some of the possible reasons for those dinim, which in the case of basa b'chala especially seems to really be a chok, is probably one of the first examples that comes to mind when you talk about a chok. You talk about something that doesn't have an obvious reason. Yet, we saw in that discussion that there were a lot of those who were with us during the year, we saw that a lot of the lumdus could possibly connect to a reasoning within the mitzvah. And we saw that with shchita also, shchita was something which was also probably a chok, but a little bit more intuitive under the assumption that a lot of the Rishonim had, that shchita is because of some kind of tzar balei chayim considerations, and we talked about how that ties in. In this sugya particularly, it is maybe unique. There is a particular connection that has to be considered between the tamei hamitzvos and the way the mitzvah plays out. Now, why is that? There's a special history, perhaps, to this mitzvah. And that history is built into how we relate to the mitzvah. So, for example, do you get a chance to see the Rambam in Perush HaMishnayos? Right, the Rambam in Perush HaMishnayos here has a line which is very often quoted and has to do not just with this din, but how we relate to Torah Bechlal, and he has a few other examples how to apply it. But it certainly has implications that are particular to this sugya. So what's the Rambam's main point over there in Perush HaMishnayos? And the truth is, saw some of the Gemaras not so different from what the Gemaras say almost straight out. But what is the Rambam's basic point over there? Yeah, Rafi?
That the mitzvos are really from like Hashem, from our Sinai and through Moshe, and not necessarily through previous commandments that may have been for earlier generations.
Right, so even when you have a mitzvah like Gid HaNasher, which seems not only to be connected to a story in Chumash, but the statement of the din appears in that place in Chumash, right? Even more so than other things. So there's room to think that it comes from that story, and the Rambam says that's not how we are impacted by it. So that's something which there's a lot to consider, a lot to expand upon. We'll try to keep it focused on what's relevant to us, but just to say a few words. So the Rambam over there, he gives a few examples, right? And if you have look at the Sefer Achinuch. So we know the Sefer Achinuch has a list of all the mitzvos in the Torah, and he organizes them by parsha. But you don't have too many in all of Sefer Bereishis. Sefer Bereishis, you only have 3 in the Sefer Achinuch, which we understand, because there wasn't the Klal Yisrael yet, there wasn't Matan Torah yet, so you don't have any mitzvos being given until you get into Sefer Shmos. But nonetheless, there are a handful of mitzvos that seem to be rooted in the Bereishis Parshios, so the Sefer Achinuch puts them there. And some of the others are less obvious. So Gid HaNasher is unique because, for example, the Rambam in this comment, so he talks about a few other mitzvos, like what, for example, Bris Milah. Right? So Bris Milah, so there, okay, we understand that historically this is a mitzvah that was given to Avram Avinu and is connected to his ancestry of the Jewish people and is also a part of the Geirus process. So we could see, all right, maybe we could trace Bris Mila back to Avram Avinu. But nonetheless, still, that's just a part of history. But as far as it being a mitzvah for us, it's a mitzvah because it was given at Har Sinai. Or Puravu is also different. Puravu is a mitzvah which had stages to it. That first it was given to Adam HaRishon on behalf of all of humanity. That God tells Adam HaRishon to populate the world. And then later on it becomes focused to Klal Yisrael as one of Tayag mitzvahs. Gedanasha is different from both of those in a sense because it connects to a story in Chumash, to the fight that Yaakov has with the Malach, and the injury that he suffers at the hands of the Malach. And what's the lashon of the Chumash there? Right over there in Parshas Vayishlach, after telling us a story, immediately after telling us about this injury, it says, "It's Parak Lamed Beis, Pasuk Lamed Gimel, Al Kain Lo Yochlu V'nei Yisrael Eskid Hanasha Asher Al Kaf Hayerech." So here you have, on the one hand, a very explicit association between what happened and the mitzvah. This is what happened to Yaakov. This is the din. And saying, and therefore, the descendants of Yaakov don't eat the Gid Hanasha. So you could be excused for thinking that, okay, this is where the mitzvah comes from. This is where the tzivui is. And the Rambam tells us that, no, it's not the case, that the mitzvah as a mitzvah comes from Maimer Har Sinai. And this seems to also be what the Gemara is getting at, right? Because the Gemara on Daf Kuf, the Gemara has a back and forth with Rabbi Yehuda, who's going to be a major player here, that Rabbi Yehuda maintains that we have to assume that the prohibition of the Gid Hanasha is relevant even for non-kosher animals. How does he know it's got to be relevant even to non-kosher animals? Because it predates Hilchos Kashrus. Right? That if the mitzvah is given to Yaakov and his descendants, so we don't have kosher and non-kosher animals yet. So it must be that the din was applicable to all animals. And then the Gemara includes a response there that no, not so fast. That was only telling us about what would come later, but the mitzvah itself is given to us at Har Sinai, so it's in a context in which we do distinguish between kosher animals and non-kosher animals, so the whole point falls apart. So why is it mentioned then in Vayishlach? Why does the Torah confuse us? That becomes the important question, right? Especially within the Rambam's point, that if the mitzvah is not coming from Parshas Vayishlach, it's coming from later. So why does the Torah convey it to us there? It could lead to a misunderstanding. So says the Gemara that this is in order to teach us Tamo, to teach us its reasoning. So that's significant for us, because that suggests that the reason is more significant than by other mitzvos. Right? Other mitzvos, we can speculate as to the tam, we can theorize, we can try to make points based on the context, but usually we don't have mitzvos with reasoning spelled out. Here, it sounds like the Torah is going out of its way to make sure that we understand the tam. And that's an important point in general, because that could impact how halacha is derived. In our case, most of what we'll see is something which is already addressed in the Gemara itself. There's a number of machlokas, and as we'll see, Rabbi Yehuda especially gets into arguments about many of the details that the opening Mishnah tell us. But nonetheless, the dinim are pretty much all addressed, or a lot of them are addressed in the Mishnayos and in the Gemara itself. But the whole role of Tamei HaMitzvos in the din seems to be particularly important in the case of Get Hanasha, that somehow it is connected in a stronger fashion to the historical episode of Yaakov than other mitzvos are. In general, it's interesting that we talk about mitzvos derabanan. So mitzvos derabanan, we know, so Chazal will make a gezeira sometimes, they'll make a safeguard, and there's a whole discussion to be had if that's based on a certain reason. If Chazal put in a policy because of some factor, so what would happen if that factor would change? What if that reason is not relevant anymore? So do we have the right to apply the halacha based on our assumption of what the reason is? So this is a big discussion. Tosfos, Gemara, has a lot of different sources. And there are some who assume, as a truth in the Mishnah Yaakov about this, that it all depends. If when the rabbis made their enactment, so they expressed what the reason was. They said, don't do X because of Y. So then we have the right to assume that if Y isn't relevant anymore, that could affect the way the din is carried out. But if it's not incorporated into the formulation of the din, so then that's a different story. Which is not as helpful as it could be, because when the Gemara tells us, oh, it's a din d'rabbanan A because of B, it doesn't necessarily mean that that's how it was communicated. It means that's how the Gemara communicates it to us. But it doesn't answer our question that might be so important. When they made the enactment, was this spelled out or not? So this policy we see in the Torah itself, because the Torah also at least has some achronim understand it, that our ability to paskin the halacha based on a tam may be connected to if the Torah itself spells out the tam. So, for example, the Rush holds that even though there's a mitzvah to write a Sefer Torah and to own a Sefer Torah that you wrote, so many of us haven't done that so far, and the Rush explains it's because really the purpose of the mitzvah is so we'll have a text at home to learn from, and nowadays we have printed Sfarim, or in his days they had a mass-manufactured Sfarim, however they were, so we can acquire Sfarim, and that's going to accomplish the goal. So the Achronim ask, the Beis Yosef, and I was talking about this, what right does the Rush have to decide, oh, this is what the mitzvah is about, and we can apply the halacha accordingly? So some of them explain, because the Torah tells you what it's about. The Torah spells it out. It says, V'yata kisvu lechem, in the end of Parshas Hazinu, V'yata kisvu lechem es ha-shira hazos, V'lamdes b'nei Yisrael simu b'fihem, that the Torah says you're supposed to write out the Torah so that you can teach the Jewish people from the text. So when we know, specifically because the Torah identifies it, what exactly the purpose of the mitzvah is, so then that gives us more latitude to apply the halacha based on that. And the machlokas in here, in this case, at least we find machlokas in the Gemara itself, in the Mishnah and the Gemara itself, seem to be focused on that especially. And here we understand the Torah goes out of its way to associate this with the Get Hanasha, with the Get Hanasha of Yaakov, with his injury. Even though that could have been confusing, even though the Rambam has to tell us that really the mitzvah doesn't come from there, the mitzvah comes from Har Sinai, but it's told in Parshas Vayishlach in order to explain its association. Okay, so far so good. So this much we know, right, that there's clearly a connection between the Isser Get Hanasha, the sciatic nerve as it's called, and the incident with Yaakov. But still, if you want to explore Tamei HaMitzvos, so there's still another level to go to. And to ask, so what? Okay, so Yaakov got injured in the sciatic nerve. Why does that have any relevance on whether or not we should eat filet mignon, I think that's what it's called, right? That's requires eating that part of the animal. So why is that relevant? Why should one lead to the other? So the most common approach is that this is some kind of a zikaro, right? That this is some kind of a testimony of a way to remember it. Why is this story important to remember? Right, what's the value of this story specifically? That it requires a special reminder. So the Rashbam, for example, has a few reasons. The Rashbam writes that this shows us the Gvura of Yaakov. We want to remember that. Or we want to remember the Nisim of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, how he saved us. And in the Sefer Achinuch, this is one of his themes, that even as we're in Galus, we should remember that God is going to look out for us, which then fits into a whole Parshas Vayishlach theme. That Parshas Vayishlach begins with how Yaakov is preparing to encounter Esav and the various steps that he takes, and we have a tradition that this is kind of a model for our interaction with adversaries throughout all of history. So then it fits the theme. Okay, so the notion that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is watching over us during these experiences, that we should remember through the Gid Hanasha. The Ralbag has an interesting point, that the Ralbag says another element here in the Pirsum, because according to some of the Rishonim, this was actually something that happened in a Maria. This was something that happened in a vision. It wasn't actually a physical interaction with the Malach. And nonetheless, you see how real it is, because it had a physical impact. It created an injury, even though it wasn't taking place in the physical world. So if that's the case, so that all the more so requires piercing, requires publicity. So this is an approach that you find in some of the Mefarshim, that it's there to publicize this event, and for whatever reason, whether it's the Gvur of Yaakov or the Nisim of HaKadosh Baruch Hu or the like, it's there as a piercing. But there's something very difficult about that, to look at this mitzvah for piercing purposes. Something a little hard about that. Can anyone help me out? What's a little difficult to explain, if that's what's going on? And we think, what seems to be a little funny? Yeah, Ari?
I mean, usually if you're publicizing a miracle, it has a good ending. If we see our hero is limping away, so it doesn't seem to be such the miraculous event to emphasize.
Okay, maybe. That's an interesting question, an interesting angle to come from it. Shmuel, what would you say?
Maybe from a more practical perspective, that if you want to publicize something, lack of doing something doesn't generally publicize it.
Ah, exactly. So that's what I was looking for. Ari's point is interesting also, but that's what I'm looking for. Right? If you think about it, where do you find something like this in Halacha? That Zikaron is through not doing it? Right? The average religious Jew, I mean, you could say this is just how circumstances developed, but nowadays, the average observant Jew, the halacha of Gid Hanasha will mean to him that he will never encounter a Gid Hanasha. Right, it's one thing if you say the mitzvah is maybe primarily given to somebody who's shechting and preparing his own meat, so maybe the act of removing the Gid Hanasha is really the mitzvah. Maybe, but certainly practically the way it impacts on our lives, so we have nothing to do with the Gid Hanasha. So we'll go our entire lives, if you're not involved in butchering and shechting, you'll probably go your entire life and never encounter a Gid Hanasha. So that seems to be a very unusual kind of zikaron. And it's interesting, Parshas Vayishlach, so sometimes if you know, darshan about this, so it's usually close to Hanukkah time when the Parsha comes up. So you can imagine, at Hanukkah we have the whole theme of Pursumei Nisa, so we know we have to light a menorah, and we have to put it in a public place. So you imagine if we say, okay, Pursumei Nisa, make sure to extinguish all lights. Make sure not to have any lights in your house to be mefarsim the nes. That's not going to help. That'll mean you'll forget about the nes. So it seems like a pretty powerful question that how could it be that this is a Zikaron, and yet it's something that by its very nature means we're not going to ever encounter it. We're not going to see it. Reb Moshe Feinstein has a drasha about this in a Sefer Darash Moshe. The way he understands it, I think he addresses this point a little bit, and he says that, yes, the idea is that it's to help us have emuna, that we will be helped in overcoming nisyonos, but ideally we'll avoid the nisyonos in the first place. So to not even encounter it, that's an extra level. Could be. But there might be also then more room to suggest other angles, and that maybe it's not about a positive quality, but it's about a negative quality. Right? Clearly is associated with this episode, that Parsha tells us unequivocally, and that's emphasized by placing the mitzvah there. So we're sure that it's associated with the story of Yaakov, but maybe it's not necessarily a zikaron, maybe there's something bad about it, and that's what it's trying to tell us. So some of the Rishonim say it's an onesh. What would it be an onesh for? So it's interesting that the emphasis, right, when the Torah asks it, so or the Torah tells us that we don't do it, so who does it talk to? Right, it doesn't say Yaakov, understandably. The language of the Pasuk is Al-Kain, Lo Yochlu V'nei Yisrael, right, the descendants of Yaakov. And the language of V'nei Yisrael is also something some of them pick up on, because at that point you would call him B'nai Yaakov. You would imagine not referred to as B'nai Yisrael until later, which also is part of the indication that this is a mitzvah from Sinai, the usage of that phrase, B'nai Yisrael, rather than B'nai Yaakov. But there are some who understand that in the context, if it's addressed to his family, B'davka, and not to him, so maybe it's an onesh. What would it be an onesh for? Rafi?
For letting Yaakov go back alone?
Yes, exactly, right? So who says this? Chizkuni says this, and Tosfos HaRosh, that there is Vayivaser Yaakov Levado, right? That Yaakov was left alone. So what's wrong with that? So you could say the Kibarav, maybe. But also there's a mitzvah of Levaya, which is an important concept in and of itself, that we associate that with the mitzvah of Hachnasas Orchim, and that we find that in Vayera with Avram Avinu, and the way, especially the way the Rambam formulates that whole story, that we assume there's a mitzvah of hosting people, of Hachnasas Orchim, and that when you're finished, so you're also supposed to escort them out and escort them along their way. So that's how we normally hear about the mitzvah of escorting, of levaya, same word as we use for a funeral, because we're escorting a person on his final trip. So the levaya mitzvah, we normally associate it with achnasas orchim. But what's important to emphasize here is not just if you had somebody in your house. It exists by itself also. Right? It exists that if somebody is vulnerable and out there in the open, so we're supposed to try to protect them. We're supposed to try to accompany them. So, for example, the source in the Torah of this mitzvah, Levaya, so some point to Achnasas Orchim and Vayera, some point to Parshas Shoftim. What do you find in Parshas Shoftim? Egla Arufa. So by Egla Arufa, when you have somebody who's found deceased, and the elders have to say, the Zekanim have to say, Yadeinu lo shafchu, that we didn't kill him. And Chazal explained that no one thinks that they actually did kill him, but maybe they passively allowed him to die because of a lack of levaya, a lack of accompaniment. So some point to shoftim and some point to here, that there is an obligation to protect somebody who's out there in the open, even if he didn't come to your house for a meal, and this mitzvah exists by itself. So according to the Chizkuni and the Rush and others, so we have an onesh that we are kept away from the Git Hanasha in order to emphasize that we left something out, in order to emphasize that we have to take care of people. And Yaakov got hurt because he was vulnerable, because he was unprotected. So we pay the price for his injury. And the Russia's language is that something like Hifsid Michael Tov, that they lost out on this delicacy because they weren't there for him at the time. So therefore his descendants pay the price and they lose out on this delicacy because the injury happened because they didn't protect him. That's another possibility. There are others who understand that there is something bad about the Git Hanasha itself, and therefore we stay away. The Or HaChaim, for example, has a kind of Kabbalistic idea. You find this in the Zohar as well, that this is touched by the Satan, it's touched by the dark forces, and therefore it's bad for us. And it was moved out of its place, which as Rashi explains in Chumash and also in Chulin, that's what the word Nosha means. The Nosha Mkomo, that it was moved out of its place, it jumped, that's how Rashi says, it jumped out of its place, and therefore it's taken out of its context of Kiddusha and is tainted. And we should stay away from that which is conferred with Tuma in this way, and that's why we have such a prohibition. Now, the Nitziv has a comment that it's to symbolize that you shouldn't be too rigid, like the Gid, and that Yaakov had a little bit of rigidity, and that wasn't necessarily what's best for him, and that we should avoid it. So that perhaps has a maybe more intuitive path to it, that if we say that the Git Hanasha is bad, so then, okay, so we stay away from it because it symbolizes something bad, or it symbolizes something good that we aren't roi for because of our history, so we should feel the pain of not having the Git Hanasha and be reminded to take care of people. So maybe that fits in a little bit more smoothly. Right, so you could either say, so we've seen now a few approaches, you could either say that it's some kind of a piercing, but that gives us the problem because what kind of a piercing do you have by avoiding something? Or you could say that, no, that's the point, that we're avoiding it because it's good, but we don't deserve it, the Onesh theory. Or you could say that it's bad, and that's why we avoid it. And it's bad for Kabbalistic reasons, bad for symbolic reasons, etc. I think you could also say, and the Sfornos is something like this, and I think this is maybe a kind of harmonizing approach, that maybe the point is that, yes, we are remembering the Nes that and the Hatzalah of Yaakov, but there's a complex message here. So this is to go back to Ari's point. So what kind of a Yeshua was this? So if he walks away limping, so is that something that we're happy about? So maybe the answer is yes, we're happy because ultimately he survives. And so even if there was an injury here, but he still overall emerges victorious and goes on to great history. So we are happy about that. And if that's the case, so how do you put this together? So how could it be that this is a testament to what happened with Yaakov, but also it plays out as a negative? So maybe the idea is, and this is similar to what you find in the Sforno, that our mitzvah here is to show that this is something that doesn't mean anything to us. That if that's where Yaakov was injured, we push right through it. That taking a hit there doesn't stop us. Okay, we'll live without the Git Hanasha. Okay, who needs to get a nusha? You know, like when somebody steps on your toe and you say, it's okay, I have 9 more. Right? So, fine. Take that one. Doesn't matter. I keep on going. So too. Okay, he was hitting the Gidanasha. We don't care about the Gidanasha. We can go along without it. And it's a show of endurance, and it's a show of focus to be able to push forward with that. So if that's the case, so that could also explain, and this is one of the details that we'll get to. So we've seen already as a machlokas in the Gemara, and probably machlokas later as well, how expansive is the prohibition of the Gid Hanasha? Right? Is it a prohibition of achila? Or is it more than that? Is a prohibition of Hana'ah as well? Which is a back and forth of the Gemara and the like. So, practically speaking, it's rare that the prohibition of Achila is a prohibition of Hana'ah. So we have a few things like that in Basa B'chalav and the like. But essentially, it's a chiddush, even though it's a machlokus in the Gemara. If you saw the Gemara in Pesachim that I put on your list, that the Rebbe Vohl maintains that all Yisuri Achila are Yisuri Hana until told otherwise. But if we maintain that it's like a chiddush here, that essentially it could have just been an Yisuri Achila, but it's a chiddush that it's an Yisuri Hana also, assuming that it is an Yisuri Hana, it's a machlokus. But if it is an Isser Hana, so maybe that could fit that theory as well, the one that we're just saying. That it's not simply that, okay, so Yaakov got hurt here and that's not important, so therefore we shouldn't eat it, but shouldn't be machshiv it at all. Right? An Isser Hana is to say this has no significance for us. It's not good for anything. And that's the whole theme of an Isser Hana. An Isser Hana, it's a whole discussion in Halacha, it's an extensive discussion, whether an Isser Hana has any value or not. But is there any shavius to an Isser Hana? Is there any concept of bailus? Can you own an Isser Hana? Does it make sense to own something that doesn't have value? Which gets into the whole Pesach discussion, and it's a little bit of a preview for next year. Right, to get into the question of is an Isser Ba'ira Ba'yimatze on Chametz, and how could it be that you can have a prohibition to own Chametz if Chametz is Asr Bahana? Maybe there's no such thing as owning Chametz. And the Gemara suggests that Chametz actually is a unique situation where it's something that is not really in your Rishus, and the Torah considers it if it's in your Rishus. That's a topic for Pesachim. But the concept being that if something is Asr Bahana, it may not have any kind of value to us at all, and it's not shaykh to own it. So it could be that that's what's going on here also, that Lamanda Omar, that there's no Hana permitted from the Gid Hanasha, maybe it's like this theory, that essentially the message is, if this is what was injured, we can push past it, we don't care. There's no chashivas at all given to the Gid Hanasha because it's something that we're able to persevere over its injury. Okay, so far so good? Okay, so what we'll try to do with that background in the next few minutes, and then we'll see more details about this tomorrow, is that we'll look at some of the discussions that the Gemara has about Gid Hanasha and some of the debates, and we'll see how that could fit into some of this reasoning. So, first of all, before we look at our Gemara, so if you saw the Gemara in Pesachim, so the Gemara in Pesachim has a discussion which actually ties in directly, in a perhaps a surprising way, to the Gemara that we started off with, this man, the Gemara that is in the context of Gnevis Das, that there, so the Ravo has the opinion that any time the Torah has a prohibition of Achila, so Achila is just a reference to all Hana. So let's just look if you have the Gemara in front of you, the Gemara in Pesachim, Adav, Chav, Beis, Amar, Aleph. So in that context, so the Gemara asks, is it really possible to say that an Isser Achila is an Isser Hana across the board? So Masir Vitzchuk Nafka, so he asks as an objection, V'arei Gid Hanasha, what about Gid Hanasha? The Rachmana Amar Al-Kain Lo Yochlu, B'nai Yisrael's Gid Hanasha. Right, so there, there's an Isser Achila. And doesn't that tell us, therefore, that should include Hana also? According to Rabbi Vo, so says the Gemara. No, so v'tnan sholeich adam yarech l'gai v'ganash shabasochem apnei shemakomo nicker. All right, so that Gemara that we're familiar with—that's what started off a whole discussion of Gnevas Das. So there, the Gemara says that you're allowed to presumably sell this part of the animal that includes the Gidhanasha. And we're not concerned for the various factors, or we are concerned for other factors. The Gemara talks about that we are or aren't concerned about, will this lead to it being sold to a Jew, or will it lead to it being deceptive in a Gnevas Das issue. But it seems that we're not concerned about the fact that you're selling a Gidhanasha, or getting some kind of benefit from this Gidhanasha. So apparently it's mutter. Apparently you're allowed to have hana from the Gid Hanasha. So the Gemara has a response to that. So Rabbi Vo would say, Kasav Rabbi Vo, Kishahutr Hanevela, Hi Vechelba Vigido Hutra. So maybe that's all included in the Heter Nevela. Because in the context of Nevela, the Torah tells us explicitly that you can get hana from a nevela. That's the Gemara. I didn't give you the whole Gemara because it was a whole long back and forth, so just zeroed in on this part of the Gemara. But the Gemara has a whole back and forth about this, that in the context of nevela, so we're told if you have an animal that wasn't shechted properly, so you don't have to destroy it, but you can feed it to the dogs, or you can sell it to a non-Jew. Which opens up, by the way, a whole other discussion, because there's a prohibition midrabanan to sell non-kosher food. And that gets into a whole discussion. So how can the Torah say you're allowed to sell the nevela to a non-Jew? Isn't that a violation of selling non-kosher food? So the Taz discusses how it doesn't seem like it's really a problem. It's a prohibition midrabanan. So it could be allowed in the Torah, and the rabbis prohibited it. So the Taz here has, in a few other places, he has an often quoted Chiddush, which I think we've talked about a little bit during the year, that Chazal prohibit things the Torah doesn't prohibit. But Chazal cannot prohibit something that the Torah explicitly permits. So if the Torah says, Beferish, it's okay, so then Chazal wouldn't come and answer it, or can't come and answer it. So then there's a whole discussion. It must be the parameters are different. It's a very often quoted Taz, so much so that Reb David Cohen, the Talmud Chacham from Brooklyn, so he has a whole Sefer, which was part of a essay published previously. The Sefer is called HaTaz HaYadua, the famous Taz, because this Taz is so often quoted. So the Torah says you can sell a Nevela. So Rav Avoh would understand, okay, so that's a chiddush, that min hadin, if it was left to itself, a nevela would be asur b'hana, because you're not allowed to get hana from anything that you're not allowed to eat. So why is that not true by nevela? Because the Torah tells you it's not true. If the Torah spells it out, that you're allowed to sell it, that's the chiddush that allows nevela b'hana. So, in that context, when you're selling the Gid Hanasha of this animal, it's the Nevela to begin with. So, the Heter that applies to the Nevela applies to the whole animal, applies to the Gid Hanasha also. So, here the Gemara has a significant response to that. So, the Gemara says that if that's the case, you're assuming that the Gid is a normal part of the meat of the animal. That you have all of the edible basar of the animal, and the gid is a part of that. But, says the Gemara, Hani chalamanda amar yesh begid and benoy sing tam. But if you say that the gid is a normal meat that is something that transfers taste because it has tam and a meat quality to it. So then fine. So then when there's a heter from the nevela, so then it applies to all that's a part of the nevela. But elamanda amar ain't begid the benosing tam. If you're going to say that, no, it's not a normal meichel. And maybe it's not called basar. Some svarim have that discussion. Maybe it could be called a meichel, but not basar. So somehow, if you want to say that it's not a part of the meat of the animal, so then, ma'ik lememar, so then, how would you say that this heta nevela is going to apply to gir hanasha also? So man shamislay. So who is it who said the amar ain begin of no sin tam? Who is it who says no sin tam begin? So that's Reb Shimon. Tanya ha'ochel gir hanasha shel behema tmeya. Reb Yehuda mechayev. Reb Shimon pota. So there's a machlokas. What's the story by a non-kosher animal? If you have a gir hanasha of a non-kosher animal, so Reb Yehuda holds that's still subject to the iser of gir hanasha. And Reb Shimon is poter. Right? You recall, as we said before, this is Reb Yehuda explained it, because since the whole Isser goes back, the way he originally thought, goes back to Yaakov, so that was before there were kosher and non-kosher animals, so it applies to non-kosher animals also. So, according to him, okay. So then it's a different story. But Reb Shimon, who holds that, no, that that's not included in that Isser, so he's the one who says ain't begin to be no same time. So Reb Shimon Hachanami the Aser Bahana the Tanya Granash Mutta Bana the Reb Yehuda Reb Shimon Aser. So the Gemara connects that issue to here as well. So what emerges, and we'll follow up on this more tomorrow, is we see a couple of major issues here. Is the Gid Hanasha Aser Bahana or not? Is the Gid Hanasha considered to be no sin tam? Is it considered to have a normal status of Isser and Heter? And does it apply to non-kosher animals? And if yes, if no, what are its limitations? So this is the subject of, or limitations overall, are the subject of the Mishnah in the beginning of the Parak. Right, which now we can see really sets a tone for the whole parak, or the whole mitzvah at least, because the Mishnah begins, Gid Hanasha, Noeg Ba'aretz Uvechutz La'aretz, it applies in Eretz Israel and outside of Eretz Israel, B'fnei Abayis, V'lo B'fnei Abayis, whether you have a base of Mikdash or not, B'chulin Uvemikdashin, and it applies whether you're dealing with Hektish or non-Hektish, the noheg bebehema uvachaya, and it applies whether you're dealing with a wild animal or a domesticated animal, v'yerach shel yamin or v'yerach shel smol, on the left side or on the right side, the einu noheg ba'of mipnei she'ein lo kaf, and it doesn't apply to a bird because it doesn't have that part of the body. So that's interesting also, because some of the svarim point out that that could have already been understood from Chai V'Oth. So there is something there calling specific attention. V'noig b'shlil, and it applies even to an unborn animal. And Rabbi Huda Omar, eino noig b'shlil. And Rabbi Huda says that it is not applicable to a shlil, to an unborn animal. So we have a couple of exclusions and a couple of expansions. So all of that, we have to figure out exactly what are the implications of all of those dinim, especially because we'll see that Rabbi Yehuda explicitly argues on some of them, and later on in the Gemara he's going to be invoked more times to argue on almost all of them. And what exactly is the significance of the machlokes? Why is it that Rabbi Yehuda and Chachamim are in this debate about things? Maybe that's something that reflects back the original source of the story, going back to the whole Yaakov incident. Another issue to keep in mind, as we continue this tomorrow, is we'll see that the question of Ein Isser Chalal Isser is going to be a major issue here. That if you have something that's already prohibited for one reason, so when you impose upon it another issue, so normally the rule is Ein Isser Chalal Isser, that one Isser does not take effect on another Isser, which would have implications for Malkus and things like that. But there are a lot of exceptions, so that's also something that we have to figure out. So if the Isser is more expansive, or if the Isser is more severe, so that also impacts on things. And there are some who suggest that maybe if we look at it as a zikaron, if we look at it as some kind of a pirsum, so maybe that also affects the whole Isser Chalal Isser question. Because maybe it affects how we categorize the Isser. That maybe in general we talk about kashrus rules, we're talking about macholas asuris. We're saying that this food item is prohibited, it has some inherent issue with it. But maybe Gid Hanasha should be perceived differently. Maybe we should look at it as an Isser Gavra, that it has to do with the individual specifically, because it's all about your perception, your relationship to this, that it's supposed to evoke some memory in you, and therefore maybe it doesn't have a prohibition in the object, it has a prohibition in how we relate to it, what you call technically an Isser Gavra rather than an Isser Chefza. Now again, that's still a little bit difficult, because to say there's an Isser Gavra so that you remember but you don't do anything, that's the problem that we started with. But okay, so the Isser would have to manifest itself as an action of negation, essentially, an action of depriving Cheshivas. So all of those details we'll have to expand on tomorrow. And again, hopefully we should cover this topic by tomorrow. But just to recap the main points, so we saw that Gid Hanasha is unusually connected to a specific story in the Torah, and in Sefer Bereishis even more than, let's say, Bris Milah or Puravu, which also have connections to Sefer Bereishis, but here it's explicitly stated, this is the story, the Jews don't do this because of that. The Rambam still then pointing out in Perasha Mishnayos, and it sounds like the Gemara is saying this also, that it does not mean that's where the mitzvah comes from. The mitzvah is because it was said at Sinai, and it's only there because of the story, and the Gemara has that phrase to tell us the reason. So it suggests to us that the reason is particularly relevant when it comes to Gid Hanasha, and that's going to affect how we understand things. So we mentioned a few approaches in the Tameh HaMitzvos beyond its connection. So some understand that it's a pirsum of the heroism of Yaakov, or the nace that he was saved, or the fact that this vision had a real impact. But then we brought up the question that if it's a zikaron, so what kind of a zikaron is it to not do something? It's the opposite of a zikaron. We'll have nothing to do with the Gid Hanasha because of this. We mentioned Rav Moshe's word about it's about avoiding the shonis in the first place. But we said it works a little better if we believe that there's something negative, or maybe something good that we're deprived of. So some of the Rishonim understand it reflects the mitzvah of Levaya. We are punished, the descendants of the family were punished for not being Malavahim, so we lose out on this good Michael. And some understand there's something bad about it, Alpi Zohar, Alpi Kabbalah, or Alpi its symbolism of rigidity. Or, we said, like the Sforno indicates, that because that was the injured place, we want to show that it's something that we are able to rise above and we don't care about it all. It doesn't mean anything to us, which, as we pointed out, would work even more so if you do see it as an Isser Hanah. So that's specifically not about not eating it, but about giving it no chashivas at all, giving it no importance. And then we saw that there were a number of issues that the Gemara brings up that we'll have to clarify. So one is there Gemara in Psachim, is there an Isser Hana or not? Is there a concept of Yesh Begin Benosin Tam or In Begin Benosin Tam? Does it have a status of Michael or status of Basar? And the like. And also the question of does it apply to a Behema Tameo or not? And we saw then the Mishnah that starts off this parak lists a bunch of rules, what it applies to, what it doesn't apply to. Applies to a behema and a chaya, not to an oaf. Applies to both sides of the body. Applies to hektish and to chulin. And we'll see that Rabbi Yehuda argues the Mishnah on some of these and the Gemara on other of these. So we'll try to see how that plays out. And also the question of, if you see it as the Zikaron, should that make it more of a mitzvah on the Gavra rather than on the Hefta? It's about how you relate to it rather than the item itself. Okay, so far so good. Any questions? Any issues? Okay, so I wish you a safe and healthy day, and God willing, we'll continue tomorrow. And it should be only good things.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Kol tov.
Thank you.